Welcome to the deep dive. We're here to take a complex stack of sources and, well, pull out the core truths you really need to grasp. Today, we are tackling something that's honestly, it's one of the most persistent, maybe most painful paradoxes of our time. The failure of peace. You hear it all the time, right? It's the promise leaders make constantly. Diplomats, institutions, everyone promises peace. And yet, if you look at the data, look at the world around us, it's probably the most consistently broken promise there is.
It really is a profound contradiction.
Yeah.
And the material we're diving into today confronts this head on. We're looking at a very deep analysis focused on what it calls the collapse of conscience in global affairs, particularly how that collapse relates to terrorism, to failed diplomacy, and maybe most controversially, to geopolitical inaction or complicity.
Right. And our mission here, for you listening, is to really unpack the central, very challenging thesis that these sources put forward, which is peace without awakening becomes complicity.
Exactly. And it's crucial, I think, that the sources start by setting a really stark ethical baseline. Right from the get-go, it frames everything else. They insist on this absolute moral truth, one they argue should govern everything, you know, regardless of politics or perceived necessity.
An absolute moral truth? What is it specifically?
It's incredibly simple and also completely unyielding. Killing is never acceptable under any circumstance, period. The source material argues quite forcefully that taking a life, even if you claim it's for security or justice or liberation, it's an act that fundamentally invites destruction, not just personal destruction, but it unleashes chaos, future suffering, often upon the very people you claim you're trying to protect.
So that clarity, that absolute stance, is the foundation. Without it, everything else starts to wobble.
Precisely. It's essential for understanding why we see these catastrophic failures globally. When that absolute moral alignment is lost, when it gets fuzzy or conditional, the system, no matter how noble its stated goals, it just collapses into moral ambiguity. Or worse.
Okay, so let's unpack that. If that absolute standard is the baseline, then the fact that violence persists everywhere suggests a massive, maybe universal failure of conscience. The source calls this failure complicity. So first things first. What is this awakening that's missing? And how does its absence turn peace efforts into, well, betrayal?
Right. The awakening they refer to is essentially the recovery, or maybe the rediscovery, of moral clarity and conscience within leadership, within governance itself. It means acting not out of, say, political calculation or fear or pure self-interest, but from an unwavering commitment to basic human dignity.
So without that awakening, complicity isn't just an accident, it's the default.
It becomes the default operating system, yes. When leaders are asleep to this core moral truth, the sources argue, they inevitably prioritize other things. Survival of their office, maybe, or preserving an alliance or economic gain. Human life slips down the priority list.
And in that sleep, as you call it, they end up creating what the source calls a convergence of betrayals. So complicity isn't one person doing something wrong. It's systemic, a kind of moral handoff.
Exactly, a moral handoff. That's a great way to put it. Various actors, often citing necessity or national survival, they each play a part, and their actions converge to sustain the violence. They don't necessarily coordinate in a room, but the effect is coordinated.
Interesting.
And the framework argues that something like terrorism, for instance, it doesn't just stay as isolated attacks. It morphs into these sustained geopolitical campaigns because a whole network of global actors enables it. It's like a shared infrastructure, but one built on moral decay.
Wow.
And the source insists we have to name these roles. Very precisely. Clarity is the first step, right, to dismantling the cycle. They defined six specific phases of complicity. These are the roles that actively sustain terror and corrode any real chance of peace.
Six phases. Okay, let's walk through them. Starting with the most direct, I assume.
Yes. We begin, naturally, with the perpetrators. This is the sharp end. Direct violence, the individuals, the groups who plan, execute, and often glorify acts of terror. Their goal is deliberate. Break the social order through fear. The responsibility is, well, undeniable. They pull the knife, pull the trigger.
Okay, clear enough. So, moving one step back from the act itself, who enables them?
That brings us to the sponsors. And this is critical. Sponsors are the mechanism that turns terror from a local issue into a regional or even global threat. This can be networks, shadowy financial groups, but also, very importantly, states. States that provide the money, the arms, the training, sometimes even sanctuary. They're the ones who convert violence into a tool, leverage, a way to achieve their own strategic goals. Without sponsors, perpetrators often just fizzle out.
Okay, perpetrators, sponsors. What's the third phase? This one sounds like it gets into big power politics. Strategic allies.
Yes. And this is where, according to the source, the collapse of conscience really gets baked into the system, institutionalized. Strategic allies are typically major powers. Think permanent members of security councils, that sort of thing. They actively shield perpetrators or their state sponsors from any real accountability. Why? Usually massive political, economic, or military self-interest. An inconvenient truth, perhaps.
So they provide cover.
Diplomatic cover, yes. Mm-hmm. Maybe crucial military aid that keeps a regime afloat. Protection from censure in places like the UN. And the source really stresses this. Their silence, or their quiet support, it's not passive. It's not just looking the other way. It's an active political intervention. It's designed to keep the system of terror viable because, frankly, it serves their strategic goal somehow.
That creates a huge tension, doesn't it, between national interest and global morality?
A fundamental tension. It basically allows powerful states to outsource their moral obligations, you could say.
Okay. After the allies, who comes next? The ones who shape how we think about it. The excusers.
Exactly. They're excusers. These are leaders, influential commentators, academics sometimes, intellectuals, people who build the narrative framework around the violence. They work to normalize terror. They might say the perpetrator's actions are understandable, given history, or inevitable, or a predictable response to grievance.
So they reframe it.
They completely reframe it. They take what is, at its core, a profound moral crime, and they reshape it into a political narrative, sometimes even a legitimate political narrative.
Yeah.
And this narrative laundering, as the source calls it, is devastating. Because it lowers the moral immune system of the whole world, basically. It gives perpetrators a veil of justification to operate behind.
Makes sense. Then you have those who just don't act, the observers.
Yes. This category includes governments, international bodies, large institutions. Their defining failure is inaction, delay, silence, sometimes deliberately obscuring the facts. They form committees when people are dying. They launch fact-finding missions that take months or years.
But inaction isn't neutral, is it?
Never neutral in this context. The source makes a powerful point. Hesitation equals permission. Silence builds these corridors of impunity. It allows the sponsors and the strategic allies to keep doing what they're doing, moving resources, providing cover without any real interruption.
Okay, that's five. What's the sixth provocative one? The violent saviors.
Ah, the great irony. The violent saviors. These are actors, often powerful states or coalitions, who intervene, usually with overwhelming force, advanced technology. And they do it in the name of rescue. We're here to stop the terror, restore order, protect the innocent.
Yeah.
But, and this is the key.
Yeah.
They execute their intervention without that crucial moral awakening, without sufficient care, perhaps, meaning they end up replicating the very destruction and civilian suffering they claim they wanted to stop. Sometimes even worse, their actions might demolish entire societies. And critically, those ruined societies, with all the displacement, the bitterness, the deep grievances, they become the perfect breeding ground for the next wave of hatred, feeding recruits right back to the perpetrator.
Wow. So it's a closed loop. Perpetrator, enabled by sponsor and ally, justified by excuser, permitted by observer, and then the savior's actions, unawakened, actually fuel the next round.
It's a perfect, terrible circle. It looks chaotic from the outside, maybe unpredictable, but structurally.
Yeah.
It's a highly disciplined system of moral failure. Everyone has their part to play in keeping the collapse going.
It's not random violence at all. It's an ecosystem.
A complicity ecosystem.
Yes. That idea of a structured discipline failure, it leads right into the source's next big point, which is that this isn't new. This mechanism where noble ideas get twisted, it's happened throughout history. And it happens whenever that awakening, that conscience, is lost in how things are run. The analysis uses a really potent example to show this, historical communism.
Right. And the choice of communism is quite deliberate. It's not about debating the politics of it today, but forcing us to look at the original intent versus the outcome. We have to remember, or maybe learn, what the original vision was. Marx's vision wasn't primarily about state control in the way it turned out. It was conceived as an idea of profound liberation. Seriously, a classless society, real equality, protecting workers from the brutal exploitation of early industrial capitalism.
A central commitment to justice, shared dignity.
Exactly. A structure where power and dignity were meant to be shared, not hoarded by a few. That original idea, you have to admit, has a noble, compelling core.
Definitely. So if the foundation was arguably about human dignity, where did it go so horribly wrong? The gulags, the suppression?
And that's the universal question the source poses. The failure, they argue, wasn't inherent in the idea of equality itself. It came from trying to implement it through governance without awakening, without that constant grounding moral compass.
Okay, let's trace that collapse mechanism. How does a system supposedly built for the people end up betraying them?
It follows a depressingly predictable pattern, according to this analysis. The moment the state, or the party, captures the institutions in the name of the people, power doesn't spread out like promised. It immediately starts flowing upwards, consolidating.
So institutions meant to guard equality become something else.
They morph. Revolutionary councils, worker committees, whatever they're called, they quickly turn into instruments of surveillance, control, internal policing, protecting the system, not the people. The leadership, often convinced of its own righteousness, its historical destiny, it becomes rigid, unchallengeable.
And the shared power ideal vanishes.
Completely. It's replaced by hierarchy, domination. What started as maybe a genuine decentralized push for justice hardens into this top-down system of control. And that's the tragic reversal. The structures designed to eliminate oppression end up creating new, sometimes far more efficient and brutal, forms of oppression.
It's like the governance structure eats the philosophy it was based on.
It cannibalizes its own ideals, exactly. And the source is really clear. This isn't just a history lesson about communism. It's a diagnostic tool for any system, a democracy, a corporation, an international body. It doesn't matter how noble the founding charter is. If that alignment with basic humanity, with conscience, is lost, then calculation, fear, greed, they rush in. And they create new oppressions that often look chillingly familiar.
Which brings us right back to today, because that same failure mechanism is arguably what we see in modern diplomacy.
Yeah, that's the critical link. The source argues that the exact same dynamics, power concentration, self-protection, the reversal of stated ideals, are precisely what's driving the failures in today's peace talks, summits, security councils.
Yeah, it's fascinating and depressing to apply that collapse mechanism, you know, the shift from serving the ideal to serving narrow self-interest to the world of modern diplomacy. I mean, why do decades of these high-profile summits, these big peace processes, so often just collapse or produce agreements that aren't worth the paper they're written on? We tend to assume or hope that the leaders showing up are genuinely there for peace, but the sources really challenge that assumption, don't they?
They challenge it fundamentally. Diplomacy fails, they argue, when it operates without that awakening, because the leaders walking into the room are often driven by completely different things. Dominance, maybe? Deep-seated historical hatreds. Calculation based on false political values. They aren't coming to build the difficult, messy, moral thing called peace. They're coming to stage peace.
Stage it, like a performance.
Exactly. A performance, a theater of power, a choreography of political maneuvering. Summits become these elaborate rituals designed mainly to generate positive headlines back home. Agreements get signed, big photo ops, handshakes. But often there's zero real intention, political or moral, to actually implement those agreements once the cameras are off. The analysis says that behind almost every handshake these days, there's calculation without conscience.
So the performance is the point. It looks like something's being done, keeps the public happy, or at least quiet, while the underlying power dynamics don't really change.
Precisely. And who pays the price for this endless performance? It's the civilians on the ground. Their lives stay hostage. Their suffering might even be leveraged as a bargaining chip for the next round of performative talks. The process validates the stagecraft, not the safety of people.
And there's another layer to this. The sources argue terrorism thrives not just because of specific grievances, but because these unawakened global systems actually cultivate hate.
That's a really crucial, uncomfortable point they make. If the global system was truly committed to peace, it would actively work to dismantle the engines of grievance, of historical enmity. But instead, through selective inaction, through those vetoes we talked about, through strategic alliances, these systems often end up nurturing distorted truths. They teach generation after generation to see enemies, not neighbors. This continuous cultivation of hatred provides the endless supply line for extremist recruitment.
Which means unawakened diplomacy, by kind of ignoring the root moral corruption, actually ends up giving a platform to the orchestrators of terror, strengthening their hand.
It can, yes. It validates their role as political actors on the world stage, while the victims, their needs, their voices, get sidelined, marginalized. And this leads directly to that point about the dissolving line, especially regarding the violent saviors.
Right. When interventions happen, supposedly to rescue people, but they're done without that awakening, without care, without precision.
When the methods used start to mirror the very cruelty they were meant to stop. When collateral damage becomes an acceptable metric. when operations launched to protect the innocent end up causing widespread destruction that looks terrifyingly similar to the terror attacks themselves. Then that moral line, the crucial difference between the supposed perpetrator and the supposed savior, it just dissolves, it vanishes.
And the casualty isn't just the people caught in the middle.
The ultimate casualty is peace itself, the very possibility of it. The failure of unawakened diplomacy lies in this deliberate staging, this performance, which tragically just ends up feeding the next cycle of violence, all under the guise of negotiation.
Okay, so we've got the structure, the six faces of complicity. We've got the underlying mechanism, how noble ideas collapse without awakening. Now we need to get really practical. How is this actually done? What are the specific tactics used around the world to keep up this performance of peace while the violence continues? This is what the source calls the mask, the techniques institutions use to turn ethics into, well, choreography.
Exactly. This section is almost like the technical manual for complicity. It shows how legal tools, procedures, narratives, how they're strategically misused. Misused to make sure that violence stays manageable, politically acceptable, and crucially, continues to serve the interests of the powerful. The source lays out 10 specific tactics. These are the mechanics of the mask.
10 tactics. Okay, let's dig in. Where do we start? Managing public perception seems key. Language laundering.
Yes, that's foundational. Language laundering. It's the systematic cleansing of moral language, giving things neutral, bureaucratic, or even positive names. So, maskers become operations. Deliberate terror attacks get reframed as resistance. Collective punishment of civilians is disguised as necessary security measures.
Why is that so effective?
Because it numbs outrage. It provides psychological cover. If you sterilize the language, you buy time. The actions can continue because the public isn't processing the true moral weight of what's happening. It sounds less horrific.
Okay. And linked to that, maybe, is avoiding blame by arguing about details. Casualty accounting.
Precisely. Another way to manage the moral response. When the pressure mounts, when people demand answers about civilian deaths, the focus gets shifted immediately. Shifted to disputes over the numbers. Was it 100 killed or 150? Who figures are reliable? Did Group A kill them or Group B? This endless, often cynical debate about statistics completely drowns out the human reality. Arguing the count replaces the moral duty to end the killing. It's a shield.
So those manage the moral fallout. What about using the system itself? Bureaucracy, procedures, procedural delay.
Ah, yes. The weaponization of bureaucracy. Instead of urgent action to protect people, you get process. Endless committees are formed. Fact-finding missions launch, knowing they'll take months or years. Calendar games are played in international bodies. Timelines stretch out indefinitely. While people are suffering right now, and the source is adamant, in the face of mass violence, this isn't just inefficiency. It functions as tacit, institutional permission for the violence to continue. Help arrives too late, if at all.
And even when rules are made, they don't stick. Resolution without enforcement.
Exactly. Law becomes decoration, not discipline. International bodies pass these strongly worded resolutions, condemning actions, demanding ceasefires, votes are held, headlines generated. But on the ground, nothing changes. Because there's no political will, no mechanism, or no intention to actually enforce what the resolution says. The powerful treat international law as, well, optional ornamentation for their political stage. Real safety doesn't follow.
Which leads us to how powerful states protect their own interests within that system. The veto diplomacy.
Perhaps the most blatant engine of complicity. A single raised hand, usually by a permanent member of the Security Council, can just instantly kill any attempt at accountability. It shields a state sponsor of terror or protects an ally engaging in brutality. The veto becomes a literal get-out-of-jail-free card. It makes the entire global accountability system subordinate to the narrow political interests of a few powerful nations. It proves the rule. Impunity follows power.
And this double standard, it applies more broadly, too. Conditionality asymmetry.
Yes. This highlights the fundamental hypocrisy. Rules are applied very differently depending on who you are. Weaker states, non-aligned nations. They get aid or arms deals, but with loads of conditions attached. You must reform, democratize, cut your budget. But powerful allies, they often get a free pass. Exemptions are made regardless of their human rights record, their internal corruption, whatever. The rule isn't justice, it's strength. If you're strong enough or important enough to a powerful ally, the rules bend or break for you. Impunity is baked in.
Okay, we've covered law and procedure. What about managing the image, the optics? And avoiding direct blame. Let's start with humanitarian optics.
Right. This is about creating the appearance of compassion and relief, often while the underlying crisis continues or worsens. Think carefully staged photos of aid convoys arriving, limited relief efforts highlighted in the media. handing out blankets for the cameras. It's done even when siege conditions might persist, or when the aid reaching people is just a fraction of what's needed. The main goal of the optics isn't actually relief, it's to pacify global outrage, to make it look like something humane is being done, buying more time for the harmful policies.
And while those optics are managed, the actual tools of violence keep flowing, hidden by plausible deniability.
Exactly. This is the sophisticated way violence is supplied in the modern era. Weapons, money, training, logistical support. It moves through layers of intermediaries. Cutouts, proxies, front companies. Everyone involved in supplying the conflict maintains deniability. They keep their distance from the actual trigger pull. So the supply chain for terror or state violence never actually stops. But no powerful actor can ever be definitively pinned down in a court. It ensures impunity continues.
Clever. In a dark way. That leaves two tactics for escaping judgment. First, forum shopping.
This happens when accountability actually starts getting close. Maybe a specific court or international body looks like it might issue a meaningful judgment against a powerful actor or their ally. So what do? They challenge the jurisdiction. They try to move the case to a different venue, a more politically friendly one. They tie it up in procedural knots. They turn the justice process into this complicated maze. The aim is simply to exhaust the system, make it run out of time, money, or political will before a real judgment can be delivered.
And the final piece of the mask, controlling the story itself. Narrative outsourcing.
Yes. This is how the preferred storyline, the justification for the violence or inaction, gets cemented as accepted fact, or at least as a legitimate side of the debate. It involves mobilizing think tanks, lobby groups, PR firms, sympathetic media outlets. They flood the public sphere with reports, opinion pieces, social media campaigns, all designed to normalize the narrative that serves the interests of the perpetrator or their strategic ally. It effectively converts genuine moral debate into a kind of managed, scripted theater. And that theater, tragically, often shapes actual policy decisions.
Wow. So these 10 tactics, they work together. It's a system.
It's a complete system, the mask. It turns law into language games, diplomacy into cover, procedure into permission. And it keeps both state violence and terrorism supplied, not just with weapons and money, but with explanation. With justification. It ensures the stage looks complex, maybe even functional, but the actual outcome, the continuation of violence, is pretty much guaranteed by the design itself.
That is a really comprehensive and frankly bleak picture of how this system works. To try and bring it all together, this idea of shared guilt where everyone plays a part, the sources use a really striking analogy. You mentioned it, the murder on a luxury train.
Yes, it's a powerful way to visualize how this collective complicity operates. How the absence of awakening makes everyone culpable, even if they deny it. So imagine this scenario. A super exclusive luxury train. It's on a long journey, crossing some remote landscape, and the only passengers on board are the world's most powerful people. You've got heads of state, billionaire financiers, top military strategists, influential media barons, the real movers and shakers.
Okay, got the picture. The global elite isolated together.
Exactly. Then overnight, someone is murdered. Maybe it's a figure who represents peace or inconvenient truth found dead in their compartment.
Chaos ensues, I imagine. Finger-pointing. Denial.
Total chaos. Denial. Blame-shifting. Just like in global crises, right? Mm. Some passengers immediately blame old rivals. It must have been them. Others put on these elaborate displays of grief, swearing they were the victim's closest confidant. Many just retreat into stony silence, claiming they saw nothing, heard nothing.
Yeah.
Standard procedure.
But then the detective arrives.
Ah, the detective. The figure representing perhaps impartial investigation or maybe just clarity. And as the detective starts methodically piecing things together, interviewing everyone, examining the evidence, a disturbing pattern emerges. It doesn't point to a single killer acting alone.
Don't tell me. Everyone was involved.
That's the shocking, damning revelation. It wasn't one person. It was a collective plot. The entire journey, the setup, it was all an elaborate, synchronized conspiracy. Every single passenger on that train had a role.
Every single one.
One arranged the specific travel itinerary to isolate the victim. Another planted the weapon. Someone else created a diversion at the critical moment. Another provided a false alibi for a key player. Others simply maintained absolute, crucial silence. The killing was collective. The performance of innocence afterwards, that was collective too, deliberate and shared.
And this isn't just a crime story. It's a direct analogy for how the world handles peace and terror.
It's presented as a direct mirror. It connects all those concepts we've been discussing, the six faces, the 10 tactics, right back to this single act of collective moral betrayal. You can map the passengers directly onto the global stage.
Okay, let's try it. The ones who planned it planted the knife. Those are the perpetrators and sponsors, starting the violence, claiming it's for liberation or security.
Exactly. Then you have the financiers and strategists on board. They're the strategic allies and the excusers, funding it maybe, or framing it as regrettable but necessary, hiding behind complexity.
The powerful figures who refuse to stop the train, who use procedure to block action, they're the veto users, the observers.
Precisely. Hiding behind institutional rules while the crime happens. And the military figures who barge in later may be causing more damage.
The violent saviors. Framing destruction as rescue, but ultimately just setting the stage for the next crime.
Yes. And don't forget the media owners, the commentators on the train.
The narrative outsourcers. Turning the whole tragedy into a spectacle, managing the story, converting betrayal into just another news cycle, maybe even policy.
Every single passenger could probably justify their individual action. Duty, necessity, survival, inevitability. But the sum total, a murder plot. And the source concludes the analogy by saying, the victim on that train isn't just one person. It's the very possibility of peace itself. That collective action, that shared, masked guilt. That's how, in the source's words, peace without awakening becomes complicity in full view.
It's a devastating diagnosis. The murder on the train analogy really hits home. But the analysis doesn't just stop there, does it? It moves from diagnosis to prescription. It insists the cycle can be broken, but only if leaders genuinely recover that sense of conscience, that awakening. And crucially, this isn't just about feeling better. It's about concrete operational standards that have to change how decisions are made.
That's the shift, absolutely. Awakening isn't presented as some vague spiritual nice to have. It's framed as a necessary operational prerequisite for any peace that's actually going to last. Without it, the system just defaults back to betrayal, back to the mask. So the source defines four specific areas where new, awakened operational standards are required to rebuild legitimacy.
Okay, let's start with the individual leader. What does awakened leadership actually look like in practice? How do you measure it?
It's not measured by GDP growth. Or election victories, or how long they stay in power. It's measured by something more fundamental. The clarity and the discipline to put human dignity and core human values consistently before convenience. That means prioritizing the human cost of a decision over, say, the survival of your own political career, or the profit from a trade deal, or even the stability of a long-standing alliance, if that alliance enables harm. Decisions have to be driven by the survival of truth, the source argues, not just the survival of the leader or the state. It means protecting your own people without morally abandoning others.
Okay, that's a high bar. How does that translate to the negotiating table? Awakened diplomacy.
Well, we saw how unawakened diplomacy is basically performance, negotiating for tactical advantage. Awakened diplomacy rejects that entirely. It requires diplomats to become, in a sense, the vanguard of conscience. Their job isn't just to represent national interest, but to expose false narratives, to refuse to accept procedural delay as a weapon, and crucially, to make accountability for atrocities completely non-negotiable, regardless of who commits them.
So the goal shifts from managing perceptions to actual results.
Exactly. The focus must shift from posturing to genuine resolution. An awakened diplomat, the source contends, must ensure every handshake, every signed agreement translates immediately and demonstrably into concrete safety and protection for the people actually affected on the ground. No more empty promises.
That leads naturally to the institutions themselves. How do you fix them? Awakened governance. This seems vital given how easily they get captured by self-interest.
It's fundamental. This standard demands we restore institutions, governments, courts, international bodies to their original, almost sacred purpose, being guardians of justice and trust for everyone. That requires real, transparent accountability applied consistently, especially to the powerful. No more exceptions for allies. It means measuring things like humanitarian relief not by photo ops or tons of aid delivered, but by actual outcomes. How many lives were saved? How many people returned home safely? Did the suffering actually decrease? Systems have to be redesigned to protect people first before they protect their own procedures or the interests of those running them.
And finally, extending this outward to the whole global system, awakened global governance. How does that work when nations prioritize sovereignty?
The current mess proves that awakening can't stop at the border. Awakened global governance insists that true national security, long-term, cannot be achieved by deliberately abandoning the people of another nation to suffer. Our fates are linked. Practically, it requires new international protocols, rules where veto power can't just erase accountability for mass crimes, systems where humanitarian aid isn't cynically used as a weapon of coercion or leverage. Ultimately, the legitimacy of any global system or any nation within it should be measured by its consistent service to humanity, not just by its military might or financial clout.
So these four standards, awakened leadership, diplomacy, governance, and global governance, they're presented as operational necessities, not just ideals.
Mandatory reforms, yes. And the source material comes from work associated with the Awakened Leadership Movement, which explicitly states its mission is to restore conscience to the center of governance, to transform these systems that have, as they put it, slept for decades. ###outro. So to wrap up this really quite challenging deep dive, the essential takeaway for you listening is probably this. Complicity in global suffering isn't just a series of random, unfortunate events. It's systemic. It's structured. And it's sustained by this deliberate performance of peace, what the source calls the mask, which substitutes elegant, often cynical, choreography for genuine moral protection.
Yeah, and the choice we're left with, according to this material, isn't really between war and peace in the simple sense. It's between two ways of managing the system. We can continue with the choreography of collapse, keep the murder on the train going through delay, denial, narrative control, or we can commit to the much harder discipline of awakening, restoring truth, transparency, and the absolute non-negotiable protection of human life to the center of how we operate globally and locally.
And just to connect this philosophy to the near future, the sources mentioned something quite extraordinary they're developing, the Awakened Leadership Compass. It's described as a global research and analysis tool, maybe using advanced AI, large language models specifically designed to take these standards we've discussed, ethical clarity, moral consistency, accountable governance, and translate them into measurable, quantifiable indicators for systems worldwide.
Wow. Okay, that leaves us and you, the listener, with a really fascinating, maybe urgent question to mull over. If ethical clarity, if moral consistency can actually be translated into measurable, quantifiable, perhaps even auditable indicators for complex systems like governments or international bodies, what does that mean? What are the implications for the future of political accountability for leadership? And maybe even more profoundly, what does it imply about how we need to govern the rapidly evolving intelligence of AI systems themselves, aligning them not just with tasks, but with conscience?
It suggests, doesn't it, that the moral infrastructure of the coming century might rely on systems that can actually measure the absence of our own awakening. A powerful, maybe slightly unsettling thought that goes way beyond today's news cycle.
Definitely something to think about. We hope this deep dive into Peace Without Awakening Becomes Complicity has given you some frameworks, some clarity to question the performances you see playing out on the world stage. Thank you for diving deep with us today.
Farewell.